Oh, that we begin today's morning gathering. And welcome all the times we need, and even beyond that, there's a further ongoing welcoming to all of us. A new level of access in the field of reality, to a new level of intimacy, to a new level of knowing each other, knowing the sweet absolute, knowing how to relate, knowing what is bhakti, which is part of our big exploration today, these days, and hopefully beyond today and these days. What is bhakti? So we have been doing that these days. On our first day in the morning, we explored Sadhu Sangha. A verse around Sadhu Sangha from the Bhagavad Gita, you remember 10:9, which again is all about bhakti. Bhakti comes from Sadhu Sangha, and Sadhu Sangha is bhakti, and therefore bhakti comes from bhakti, and bhakti continues through bhakti, and bhakti converges in bhakti. Yes. We are bhakti fanatics. It's all about bhakti from beginning to end, and there's nothing else we want. But again, for us to say that with a joyful heart, we need to understand what is bhakti. Because if we have a distorted idea or even a partial idea of bhakti, we may feel it's all about bhakti, but what about this and that and that? I'm missing. We have this FOMO, as they say, right? So fear of missing out, FOMO, just in case. But we're if properly understood, we can understand there's nothing that is being missed out. If we embrace bhakti, or if we allow bhakti to embrace us properly, so we are trying to go through that, whether from the perspective of Sadhu Sangha as we did on day one, or how, as we did yesterday, trying to explore in Bhagavad Gita 9:2 different attributes of bhakti, as Krishna beautifully enumerated one after another. Though it seemed like a dry verse, but there was a lot of juice there. Does it look like a dry one, this one? Feel free to say yes, no problem. There's always some level of apparent dryness or not enough sweetness and juice, and then we just need to. Mahaprabhu will say, Ramananda Roy, or say, Eho Bahya Agi Kaha Ar. That's superficial, go deeper. No? And then we. Not like condemning where we are, but not allowing us to settle where we are. Because we reach a new level of discovery and experience and depth. Oh, great. Okay, great for today. Tomorrow we talked again, and tomorrow that's superficial, go deeper. No? That's no longer enough, that's idea. Not that that's superficial as something bad. It's just that for who you are and for what you are ready already, you're ready for more. So don't settle for less than your potential affords. So that's the ongoing journey of bhakti. On one side, we don't want to jump in too early into things that are too deep and big for us. We don't want to dive into a big that is a shoe that is too big. But also, we don't want to remain in a shoe that is too small. That starts to become painful. Right? Try to walk with a shoe that is too small. I have that experience walking up to Ananda Dam twice. I still have some scars. Literally some scars. Some scars and some scar. It's painful, it's suffocating. Or if I give you a t-shirt from where you were like 12 years old, try to wear it now. It's like it's like a torture, basically, right? But we do all that with that. We do that all the time, many times, in trying to remain in certain chapter of the journey, certain stage that we are already ready to leave and move on, move forward. So we don't want any of these two. Again, if the shoe is too small, some scars. It's painful. If the shoe is too big, you cannot walk. It's like try to walk with a giant shoe. It's like you fall. It's not walking. And with the other one, you cannot walk either. I mean, you try with both, too big, too small, but you can't walk at a normal pace in a normal way according to where you are. So we have to find the proper shoe size and be willing to upgrade the shoe size every day. Because again, every day there, Ehubahia Akikahar, we are ready for something more. So in that sense, we are trying to, again, we are bringing different verses these days that shed different perspectives in bhakti, and we are trying to get ready for something more and go deeper into something more. And again, we could pick this verse, like I say, with the other verse, and we just make a retreat around this verse. And we can try in the future, no problem. So yesterday we considered some of the qualities of bhakti. And today we are asking what bhakti consists of. What is bhakti? What's the definition? We are moving from a description of bhakti from yesterday to a definition of bhakti today. So today we'll be sharing with you Srila Rupa Goswami's official definition of bhakti. Of more precisely of Uttam Bhakti. Which for us is bhakti proper. Pure bhakti. Yesterday we in the Gita verse Krishna said Pavitram Idam Uttamam. The word Uttam appeared. And I felt, oh, maybe we can explore further Uttam by going to the Uttam Bhakti verse. So we'll share today the official definition of bhakti, not to encage bhakti into a definition, no, because at the same time, bhakti is ever again high to kiya pratihata, is constant, it's as we say yesterday, it's abhyayam, it's inexhaustible, no, it's uncontainable. So, how can you contain this in a definition? But at the same time, I will say this is a definition as we'll see broad enough to accommodate bhakti, all that bhakti is and all that bhakti can become. In potential. And the definitions are just ways of, one says there are fingers pointing to the moon. There are ways of giving us an idea and then inviting us to have the experience of the definition. I'm defining bhakti, okay, but then hopefully that definition takes you to a bhakti immersion, so to say, to a bhakti experience. If not, it's just a definition. We can learn it and that's it. But it's very important, but it has a purpose to take us beyond the definition itself, into pratyaksha-avagamam, as we said yesterday. Bhakti can only be understood by personal experience. But sometimes we need a definition to orient ourselves, like it's a form of sambandha. Okay, bhakti, I'm a bhakti, I practice bhakti. Okay, if someone asks, so what's bhakti? And sometimes we may not know what's bhakti. Or we may give it too loose of a definition. No, bhakti is devotion. Which is correct, it's not wrong. Bhakti is devotional service. It's correct. Bhakti is love. It's correct. But what do we mean by that in surgical detail? Because if not, if we our definitions remain too loose, maybe our practice guided by the definitions may remain too loose. And maybe the fruit of that will be too loose. Like a shoe that is a little bit loose. So the shoe, when the shoe is properly adjusted, it will work differently. So sometimes it's important for us, again, not to get technical or trapped into intellectuality because it's not about that, but it's about how to say becoming specific about what I want to do with my life, in my life, for the rest of my life in the best possible way. So, what's bhakti? So, Rupa Goswami gives this definition that we'll go in a moment. This The Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu, which is one of the many books by Rupa Goswami. He wrote many books, and the Goswamis, the six Goswamis unto them in themselves, they wrote many books, big body of literature. And as we explain in our introduction series on the Srimad Bhagavatam, so far introduction series, that all the books of the Goswamis are extensions of the Srimad Bhagavatam. All the books of the Goswamis revolve around the Srimad Bhagavatam. Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu is an exploration, as we will see, of the Srimad. The Goswamis wrote commentaries on the Srimad Bhagavatam itself, but then they wrote books, their own books about the Bhagavatam. It was not enough to write a commentary on the Bhagavatam. Then we had to write books. We have Bhagavatamrita. Rupa Goswami wrote Laghu Bhagavatamrita, all about Bhagavatam. But Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu, Bhagavata Sandarbha Jiva Goswami. Bhagavata, an essay, Bhagavata Sandarbha means an essay on the Bhagavatam. So you would think an essay will be like 12 pages or 15 pages. An essay on the Srimad, on the Bhagavatam. Right? Apart from him writing three commentaries on the Bhagavatam, right? Then let's write an essay on the Bhagavatam. And the essay start to get long. The idea is there's so much more to say to the Bhagavatam is not only what we know as the official Srimad Bhagavatam. That's a trailer hint of what this all about. What's the love life of God? So Rupa Goswami, among other books, he write Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu, which means the ocean of the immortal nectarian sacred ecstatic rapture of bhakti. I'm trying to describe it literal as possible. So Prabhupada was more generous and say the nectar of devotion. This is an encapsulated way of saying all that, no? He's trying to explain. He will say, I'm trying to explain the ocean. No, devotion is oceanic. No? So even if we are touched by one drop of that, we're sprinkling with one drop that our life is successful. So this is an ocean of nectarian rasa of devotion. So the whole book culminates in the notion of bhakti rasa. And bhakti rasa is a very complex and deep and comprehensive idea. But before Rupa Goswami starts to build his case gradually by describing different stages. And I will go there in a minute. It's a little bit of context to the verse. But Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu, interestingly, Rupa Goswami begins the very first words of Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu, Rupa Goswami says, Akhila Rasamrita Murti, which means Krishna is the embodiment, personification of all rasas. So that's his thesis, so to say. He takes Krishna as the perfect object of all rasa, of all sacred rapture. No? Based on what the Upanishads say, Raso Vaisaha, no? Brahman is rasa. The Bhagavatam also say when Krishna entered the arena, as I said the other day, different people saw him in different ways. So different people experienced different rasas while seeing the same person. And that's the other way around. Rupa Goswami gives a lecture, a verse when Krishna is raised lifting Govardhan, and how he is experiencing all the different rasas while lifting Govardhan, regarding to the gopis, to this, to that. I don't know, smelling the yogurt, getting, how do you say, when it gets not rotten by fermented, and Krishna expresses the rasa of disgust. Because they are the main rasa and the secondary rasas. No? So these are these two verses. In one sense, Krishna being the object, and another, Krishna being the subject. No? The object, all these people in the arena see him, and everyone experiences different rasas with the same person, and him being the subject. One person experiences all these rasas at the same time. So, from those two perspectives, Rupa Goswami says, Krishna is Akhila Rasamrita Murti. All emotional weathers of the heart in transcendence have the sweet absolute Sri Krishna as its object, but he himself is relishing all this broad. How do you say, broad spectrum of ecstatic emotional dispositions. Of course, there is something missing in Krishna, and that's why we need Gaur Lila in that connection, but that's another conversation. You should have come to Switzerland retreat. Sorry for that. But the lectures are there. Oh, that's another the appendix in the the biography of Krishna, so to say. So going to Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu again, Rupa Goswami starts with that verse, then he gives some Mangala Charana verses to Mahaprabhu, to Sanatana Goswami, and so on and so forth. And then comes this verse, basically. This is kind of the, in one sense, the first verse of Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu. I mean, it's the 11th verse. There are 10 verses before, but the first 10 verses is offering pranam to Krishna, establishing him as Akhila Rasamrita Murti, offering pranam to Mahaprabhu, Sanatana Goswami, briefly describing what the book will be about. Okay, let's start. This is the first verse. So this first verse appears in the first chapter, and in the first chapter of the first wave. Since the book is called An Ocean, Sindhu, the book is divided in waves and directions and all watery and framework, framing of the book. So the first section of the Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu is called Samanya Bhakti, which means bhakti in general. No? Like let's define bhakti, and that's how he begins. No? Then he will go to sadhana bhakti, bhakti in practice. with the subdivisions of Baidi and Raganuga Bhakti in Sadhana Bhakti. You have Baidi Sadhana, Raganuga Sadhana, depending on the case. Then another section to Bhava Bhakti, then another section about Prema Bhakti, and then conclude about Bhakti Rasa, which is the main theme of the book, Bhakti Rasa Amrita Sindhu. So it's interesting because the main theme of the book comes at the very end, and most of the book is a preparation for us to get to the actual main topic he wants to talk about. Again, like the Bhagavatam, preparations to get there, like the Gita, as we say yesterday, preparation to the ninth chapter, and then an afterthought of that. So we see this pattern in many of these scriptural works. So, but it all begins with a definition of bhakti. What we are talking about here, what's here. So what bhakti is in general. Though it gets pretty specific to some degree, but this is a generic definition of bhakti. Not to downplay it, that's the ideal beginning point, and from there Rupa Goswami starts to get more and more specific. Okay, so there's sadhana bhakti, bhava bhakti, prem bhakti. I mean, sadhana, there's Baidi and Raganuga, and there are this subdivision and the subdivision of the subdivisions. And at one point, it can get a little complicated. That's why we need to get gradually. And this is the beginning point. Okay, what's bhakti? What's the bhakti we are talking about here? So, this is the verse. I'll recite it and read the translation, and then we can. We'll try to do something with our lives around it. Anyabhilasita shunyam gyan karma adi anavritam anukulyena Krishna anushilanam bhaktir uttama. That's the verse. Short verse, but a lot being compressed there. No, it's not a sutra, it's more than a sutra, but in its own ways, it's always a sutra because there's so much to unpack from what it apparently is saying. So the translation that we are sharing here says, the continuous cultivation of service intended exclusively for Sri Krishna and performed in a way pleasing to him, free from every inclination toward ulterior desire, and unobscured by pursuits of knowledge, ritual action, or the like, is called the highest devotion, or Uttam Bhakti. So again, this is a surgical definition of bhakti, in which, as we will try to see, Rupa Goswami defines this in a way that we cannot mistake bhakti for any other thing. So from every corner, he tries to say different things. I will try to analyze word by word. So even if these things means this, still it lends for misunderstanding. So then he says this. So this is not misunderstood. But still, this one can be led to misunderstanding. So then he says this. So then that clarifies this. So each corner is like clarifying each other. So we have a crystal clear idea that doesn't lend to misinterpretation. Still, we have great potential for misreading, but he makes as much work as he can to be as clear as possible to protect us from ourselves in terms of misreading what bhakti is. So then it's up to us. And then we have the commentaries that I will be referring to today a little bit from Jiva Goswami and Vishwanatha Chakravarti Thakur to further clarify the verse in case we are still misreading it. So again, this verse can work before we go to each one of the parts and sections. This verse can work as a, in one sense, as a compass. Compass, you say?
Compass.
Compass. Okay. And a mirror. Both. Like orienting toward where we go, where we aspire, but also, shedding like light. Where we may be, not like a compass is showing direction toward, okay, what's Uttam Bhakti, what's pure devotion? I may not be there yet fully, but as we talk these days, it's healthy to have a clear aspiration. That even is I mean, an aspiration, this needs to be something that is big enough for me to aspire to that. It's not that it's already fully actualized. No. So it's something big enough that in one sense I can aspire for that for eternity. No. That I will say it's a healthy ideal that keeps you as a student forever, as Rashi will say. When you have an idea big enough, deep enough, that you can never fully accomplish it, then you remain a student forever. So this is part of it. No? When we go through the details, probably you will feel, oh, I'm not there yet. Relax, you will never be there yet. Fully. You can always get there. Again, further arrival, non-going further arrival. So in that sense, it can be a compass pointing to the direction of our aspiration. Even if I'm not there, and again, you will never be there fully. So even if I don't feel I'm fully there, which we need to coexist with that feeling for eternity, I can aspire to that in a healthy way, in a charming way, a beautiful way. So like a compass, Uttam Bhakti. But also a mirror revealing where am I now, which are my present motives. Without neurosis, again, without a festival of whipping and lashing, but with responsibility and sincerity, you know, which are the motivations behind my motivations. Because someone asks me, which are your motivations? We may have a quick answer. And then we need to put pause and drill in what's the motivation behind that motivation? What's the answer behind that? Is there something else? So again, this verse is also like a mirror, like shedding like where we are standing, which may be our present motives. Again, without condemning us for having mixed motives yet, but also without deceiving us. No, I don't have any of that stuff. Come on, guys. Right? So both compass and mirror. So that's like a daily yardstick or thermometer. Again, in a healthy way for us to see, okay, where am I today? Where can I grow today? To what can I aspire today? In which way? So our day doesn't pass just like in autopilot, you know, without any type of reflection, growth, introspection, aspiration, transformation, change. I don't know, just the day passed. I was busy doing stuff. Okay. But if you pass one day like that, probably the next day will be passing like that. And the next day, if you don't intentionally try to disrupt that numbness, and then you multiply a week like that, probably it's a month like that, and probably it's a year like that, and probably it's a lifetime like that. So it all starts with some intentionality. Mo in one moment, another moment, and another moment. These verses, like a nice compass to bring that intentionality, you know? Like the third verse of Shikshastakam also. We may not go there this time. We did a whole series a few years ago in New Zealand, so there you have it. But these are these verses you can always go there and receive some new light about where you are. And in a healthy way, be caught red-handed. Like, okay, I'm always falling short of something of that. Again, not to feel bad about it, but just like an invitation to grow. It's not so much about how miserably you are failing. But how much growth you are being invited to step into. So it's all about us how we translate in our hearts these verses in a negative way or in a positive way. So it's an art that we need to always find a positive, even if when it seems a negative injunction. And that today we'll go through that in this verse as well. So again, this is a definition of Uttam Bhakti. It seems simple and straightforward, and in one sense it is, but in one sense it's not. You know, there's lots to unpack, and that's why both, as I said, Jiva Goswami, Vishwanatha Chakravarti Thakur, they have written elaborate commentaries on this verse, on different verses, but they take considerable time for this verse in particular, like making a point, like, okay, there is something here. Right. If you are reading a book, and we have many books with commentaries to verses, and most of the commentary have this size, like one paragraph, two paragraph, and then one verse receive like 10 pages of commentaries, like, Okay, I must pay attention to this one, especially. So again, in one sense, we could say Rupa Goswami. Remember, all the books of the Goswamis are, how to say, extra churned. Yeah, they have churned the Bhagavatam and they have extracted the further essence of the Bhagavatam in the form of their books. So we could say, and especially in this verse, in these two lines, I mean, we have four, but actually there are two lines, Anyabhilas, Tashunyam, Gyan, Karmadi, and Avritam, line one and the other one. So Bhagavad Sri Rupa Goswami has churned the whole essence of the Bhagavatam in these two lines. Now, let's put it that way. I'm not exaggerating here, just to shed light on the verse in a particular way. So by grasping the meaning of these two lines, one can understand the mystery of the Bhagavatam. One can enter into that. We can live into that. One can attain the spiritual world. One can attain that, because that level of consciousness. No? So we say many times, Vaikuntha or Vrindavan is a state of consciousness. Tulsidas will say it's not simply a physical place. It's not a physical place. It's not simply a place made of consciousness. Again, Vaikuntha or the spiritual world is primarily the consciousness defined in this verse of Bhakti-rasamrita Sindhu. This is what marks the standard of living and thinking and feeling of the inhabitants of transcendence. So this sometimes devotees get a little bit too, not all, but some like, oh, let's talk about the super, as I say, jumping into a big shoe. Let's talk about Manjari Bhava and our eternal, the most esoteric thing. And again, none of that is bad topic, and I'm not condemning those who properly do that. But one way to start talking about that is learn this verse. Because this Manjari Bhava as a foundation. Then comes the details, the specificity and the names and the colors and the lilas and the dresses and the, but all of that is happening on the foundation of this attitude. So until and unless, not only we learn the verse by heart, and that's not even the main thing, but until and unless we are entering this shoe, don't trying to get new pair of shoes, so to say. So this is a verse that defines the consciousness of Vaikuntha. Vaikuntha, as we know, means no limitation also, no fear, without limits, without fear. So Vaikuntha consciousness begins whatever consciousness, again, becomes free from rivalry, dualism, calculation, self-center, appropriation. When we become free from all that, that's Vaikuntha. And when everything is turned, not to keep it just as negative, free from, turning toward loving service. So this verse is speaking about all that. So again, we could say, oh, this verse is a definition of the spiritual world. What's the spiritual world? There you have it. You practice this verse fully, you get there. As a state of consciousness, that's what it means. Huh? Anyhow, I haven't started the verse officially because it needs some introduction. Again, it's like if you are inviting an important guest, you will spend some time introducing the important guest. It's not just, okay, here it is, whomever, right? You need to like make the people aware who is about to come. And again, that's why still one lecture is not enough. We could do 3 days of introduction and then start officially, but anyhow. So this verse has two sections as described by the commentators, one called Swarup Lakshan, another called Tatastha Lakshan, which means Lakshan means like qualities. So Swarup Lakshan means like in this case, primary qualities, direct qualities. And Tathasta Lakshan in this case means like marginal or like secondary qualities, which basically come as a byproduct of the primary qualities. No? Like when we say yesterday, in bhakti, renunciation comes as a byproduct of bhakti. So bhakti is the main thing, renunciation is concomitant. So actually in the first line comes the Tathasta Lakshan and the second line comes the Swarup Lakshan. And I'll explain them starting with the Sweta Upalakshan. That's how Jiva Goswami and the commentators do in the commentary to the verse. They start with a positive thing, which then creates as a byproduct. Anyabhilasita shunyam. So again, wanting to all of you to feel comfortable as much as also you need to feel unsettled and disturbed in a healthy, sacred way. But this verse may feel aspirational. Someone is not agreeing with the verse now. No, it comes there. I say just you feel unsettled and someone is coming and deleting the verse. Oh, yeah. You're unsettled. Okay, you put unobstructed. It's fine, it's okay, no problem. Unobscure sounds more poetic. So again, this verse may feel aspirational in many ways. And again, if it does, it's very important that it does. It's great that you can find, wow, I'm receiving such a great aspiration, such a great prospect in my life. Even if I feel lifetimes away from that, I have that aspiration. That's it. No? Aspiration is not hypocrisy. Hypocrisy.
Hypocrisy.
No? Hypocrisy is pretending that you have a right. Right? I'm already there. No. Aspiration is honestly recognizing where I am and where I want to be. No. And that's ideal. So we have to always have some aspiration. Aspiration is not just what I want to go or be, but where I am, where I want to be, what's the distance in between, what it takes to get there, and the fuel of longing, eating the journey, so to say. No, it's not so much when I'm there, when I get there, I'm already there. I will never get there in a negative way. In one sense, as I wrote in Evolution Divine Law, in one sense, we're already there because we're having the chance of doing what we want to do forever. At the same time, there's no end to how much we can get there. So, in one sense, you will never get there. In one sense, you're already there. So, however you choose to frame it, do it in a way that is healthy, sustainable, grateful, and celebratory. So, both mirror and compass, aspirational and shedding light on where we are and where we want to be. So, we'll begin with the second part of the verse again, with the Svarupalakshan, with the main intrinsic primary attributes of Uttam Bhakti. And of course, the verse, just to clarify, says Bhaktir Uttama, the last two words, Bhaktir Uttama, which again come at the end of the verse. If you read the Sanskrit original, you hear first the qualities of something that you don't know what it is. And many times the Sanskrit word like this, and the last line reveals what they were talking about all the time. This is devoid of this, this has that. That is Uttam Bhakti. So Bhaktir Uttama means Uttam Bhakti. Uttam Bhakti is or is constituted of everything that will go there. So as we explained yesterday, Uttam meant something pure, transcendental, utterly Uttama, utterly beyond darkness, tamas, Uttama. And when we say pure, we are not describing like an elite person. As I say, it's not like exclusivistic. It's only for some, for the chosen ones, right? We happen to be the chosen ones. Sorry for those guys walking outside. It's not in that. It's kind of describing the direction and the quality of devotion, which becomes, as well, see, it's very inclusive, but for it to be totally inclusive, it has to also be pointing in the right direction, first recognizing what's the center of reality. So in that sense, it has to be exclusive. It has to know, okay, the center is this. It's not me, it's not my dog, it's not my house, it's not the neighbor. This is the center. So you have to be accurate in that. And then you can be inclusive. Right? So it's more about having the proper conception, even if we feel, again, I'm not there in realization, at least you can have a clear conception of this. And even if you say Maharaj, I'm a Kanishta Bhakta, I'm the supermost beginner guy here. That's fine. You can be a super Kanishta Bhakta and be practicing Uttam Bhakti. It's not that you have to become an Uttam Adhikari or Uttam Bhagavat to be practicing Uttam Bhakti. That's the difference. You have a Kanishta, Madhyam, Uttam. We have heard these three levels of devotion: the beginner, intermediate, and most advanced, and many degrees in between. And the most advanced is called Uttam. So you may hear, oh, Uttam Bhakti means that's a bhakti that is practiced only by the ones who are over there, above. No, you can be a neophyte and you can sincerely orient yourself toward Uttam Bhakti, even while still carrying mixed motives. No? But you can sincerely acknowledge, I'm still carrying this stuff. I know this is not the final version of me. I acknowledge that, but I'm orienting my life with this compass again. So if you are sincerely doing that, you are practicing Uttam Bhakti as much as you can practice for the stage you're in. So it's not so much important about are you there or not, are you an Uttam Bhagavat or not, but are you orienting your life around such an ideal? Are you orienting your life around such an aspiration sincerely? Because if you are, it's just a matter of time that you get there, whatever getting there means. You follow my point? That's why Srila Samaj will say again, over and over again, the importance of having a great ideal, in this connection. Ideal will mean like aspiration, basically. And again, an ideal that is sincerely aspired for, because I can learn the loftiest ideal and just use the ideal to not do anything. But if I have a deep ideal and sincerely aspire for and try to make that a priority in my life and align my life with that ideal, even as I fall short of it on a daily basis thousands of times in a healthy way, that again keeps the direction clear, keeps the compass clear. I don't want to cheat myself. I don't want to betray myself. I'm coming here for bhakti. Okay, what's bhakti? Oh, that's the definition of bhakti. Oh, that's challenging. Yes, of course. Okay, and I'm falling short of that. Yes, of course. But I want to sincerely aspire for that. Hopefully, yes, of course. And that's how we go through the journey. But so just to clarify that before we go to the other words. So Bhakti Uttam. That's I mean you need to be an Uttam Bhagavata for that. You can be wherever you are and be embracing this ideal sincerely. You are following this verse. You're aligned. Let's go to the word. We'll go like backwards from Bhakti Uttama to Anushilanam to Krishna to Anukulyena. So sometimes love moves in a crooked, backwards way. So Anushilanam, Anushilanam, which somehow can be translated as cultivation in terms of practice, activity. It's translated here as ongoing, continuous cultivation. Anu, the word Anu sometimes indicates like something that goes on and on, continuous. Not just like, okay, I do this once a year, that's my bhakti. It's something that we try to make it part of our life, as I like to say. Ideally, it's not just my practice and my life. It begins like that. Then it becomes your life. Your life becomes your practice becomes your life, and it's Anu Shilanam. It's ongoing, it's flowing, it's smoothly and uninterrupted. So Anushilanam, the word Shilanam, Jiva Goswami, I will be referring to him quite often. The word Shilanam comes from the root shil, and he says it has two distinct meanings. One meaning is non-active, and the other meaning is active. So now he starts to do the surgical work here. So don't get lost, please. One is contemplation, to use brief, basically one word, and the other one is like active. So when we speak about bhakti, we are talking about bhakti, remember, no? So one of the Swarup Lakshan, we are studying the primary qualities of bhaktis, anushilan, an ongoing cultivation, a continuous cultivation. So again, we may think, oh, that's again doing stuff. Yes, but also internal contemplation. So here, this device, this cultivation of bhakti in terms of active actions, whatever maybe we be doing, hearing, chanting, washing, cleaning, talking, and internal contemplation, emotion, things that happen on this. Both are shilanam. Both, the word shil means these two. So anushilanam, again, or continuous ongoing service, has these two forms. Rupa Goswami uses one more word, and sorry, I'm not writing them down here. One is chesta rupa bhakti. Chesta rupa means which uses the body, which uses the word, and related to what I just said. And the other one is bhava rupa bhakti. Rupa means form, which is more emotional, internal. So both are anushilana. It's clear?
Yes.
Jamun is not clear, friend. Jamun is short circuiting now. Yeah, I don't want you don't get to start with the terms in itself if you will. And I know it maybe writing them may help, but chistarupa bhavarupa. Chistarupa means anush culture of bhakti with the body, with words, with action, active. Bhavarupa means expression of bhakti, cultivation of bhakti internally. So both are anushilana. So again, Rupa Goswami is starting to be specific about what bhakti is. He's not saying it's just mere sentiment. As we say yesterday when we studied the verse of the Bhagavad Gita 9.2, Krishna said, kartum, susukam kartum abhyam. Kartum is, it is active, it is done, it implies action. So it's not just mere sentiment, but it's also not just doing stuff. So by giving these two possibilities of anushilana, Rupa Goswami is giving a balanced, healthy depiction of bhakti. It's not just about what I'm feeling and I'm not translating that into action. Because I can say I feel all this stuff, but how that's embodied in your day to day. But also, it's not about just doing stuff without feeling anything. Okay, so can you see just from the first word, he's given a very balanced idea. But still, we need to further qualify bhakti beyond anushilanam. It's not enough just to say bhakti is anushilanam. Still, only this term can lend itself to misunderstandings. We have not been talking still about intentionality and other things. And so anushilanam is inviting us to ask, okay, what I'm cultivating? Each word presents a question, if you will, to each one of us. Now, what I'm repeatedly cultivating, because that's what anushilanam is, ongoing, continuous cultivation. What I'm repeatedly cultivating, because what you, how does the Bible say regarding cultivation? You sow,
What you reap, you reap.
you reap. Yeah. So, what are my actions? What are my thoughts? What are my feelings? What are my repeated action, thoughts, and feelings? Because as I said before, we tend to fall into patterns of repetition. We tend to think about things in a certain way and reinforce that pattern and think always about certain things, always in that way. We tend to act in certain ways, always, and so on and so forth. And I'm not saying that's bad. It can. So which are my habits, in other words? The word repeated actions, thoughts, emotional habits are shaping our sense of identity. So, and I'm shaping what we become capable of loving, because we are talking about bhakti and love. So if my words, actions, thoughts are repeated in a certain way that is not healthy, I may become capable of loving chocolate. That's it. That's how far my love reaches. To give a tragic example, ultra-reductionistic example. Nothing against chocolate, just like chocolate is not Akila Rasamrita Murti. That's not. And that's another way of refining bhakti proper, no? Because you can say, I love chocolate. People use this word, I love chocolate. You don't love chocolate. Because love, as we are seeing now, entails you offer yourself favorably for the object of your affection. You are not doing that with the chocolate. Now, you're not asking the bar of chocolate, how can I dedicate myself all to you today? You just want the bar in your service. But we say, I love chocolate. No, you don't love chocolate. It's just a word, but again, how we use words, it gets ingrained. I love this, and that becomes an habit to use love in this way, to use words in this way. And that starts to limit my capacity of love to a bar of chocolate, to my football team, to my dog, to my di and I have, I mean, ideally we can love all those things, but first you have to love the center. Because if not, it's coming from a self-centered place. So Anushilalam again is questioning our action, thoughts, emotional habits, how we are dealing with them, our ongoing culture that allows us to love in a certain way, in a certain perimeter. And again, Anushilanam unites action and contemplation, as we say. It has both its active part expression and its internal contemplative expression. Like the ritual has the center for action and contemplation. You can say center for Anushilanam. So bhakti includes inward attention, presence, but also that inward presence and attention takes shape through body, words, action, choices, relationships. So all of that is included in Anushilanam. And of course, just to mention it, though I wrote my first book all about it, but Jiva Goswami comments in this verse says, this Anushilanam is obtainable by the grace of Krishna and his devotees, and it's a transformation of Bhagavan Swarup Shakti. So yeah, he makes it clear it's not inherent in us. We have the potential to embrace that gift, but it's a gift that is coming to us from Krishna's own internal Shakti coming through grace. He says, though it's purely spiritual and it's part of Krishna's internal Shakti, it manifests itself through body, mind, words, to all these faculties that otherwise can be unable to contact bhakti, limited by bhakti, by its grace, can descend upon mind, senses, body, and make of them a vessel to express bhakti, to contact bhakti. So bhakti is very user-friendly in that sense. It's the highest, topmost transcendental thing, the heart of hearts of Krishna, his swarup, the essence of his swarup Shakti. You cannot get higher than that. But because it is higher, it can descend to the lowest, so to say, and everything in between, and touch everything and sprinkle everything and spiritualize everything and put everything in its proper context. And all that, of course, the implication of that is therefore by mind, body are not enemies in our bhakti project. All those are implications of Anushilana. Because again, one aspect of Anushilana is active action through body, mind. Oh, that means that's not body, words, emotions are not that bad. No, they're not enemies of my spiritual life. They become instruments, they become facilitators through which bhakti can express itself in this world, in our life. So. Okay, I'm pounding the post here. It means the logic of pounding the post. Thank you. For those who are not listening or watching the video, someone is pounding a post. Okay, we are ready to go to the next word, which is Krishna. Oh. That's not only a word, huh? There's someone behind there. Krishna. So actually the compound is Krishna Anushilanam. Krishna Anushilanam. So Krishna is qualifying Anushilanam. All we say now about Anushilanam is with Krishna in the center, as the center of this continuous cultivation. As we say, if we need to ascertain which is the center. If we misread the center, Like Prabhupada said, it's all zeros. We start a project of zero accumulation. No. I have so many zeros, but the one is not there. There's a false one established at the center, and everything remains zero. So Krishna, the divine, is with absolute, the all attractive, irresistibly attractive, too much attractive. He's the center, all magnetic, attractive, irresistible center of reality. And therefore, anusilanam on this ongoing cultivation of service is to be directed in that direction. And from there to everything else, because as we say always, nothing exists disconnected to the center. And we'll get there in a minute because Jiva Goswami comments to that. But first, Jiva Goswami, again, you can see these are very non-sectarian claims that he makes in his comment. He says, in this verse, the word Krishna also indicates bhakti for other forms of God. Of course, for those who have Krishnas, there is the dev, that's Krishna. But but it's not limited to that. So that's the point. No. And of course, from the Gaudiya tradition or Gaudiya perspective, we say, okay, Krishna, in one way, we think of Krishna as the original form of God, though there's no origin. Like it's not like now, then this began. But in terms at least of rasa and intimacy and sweetness, it's conceived, okay, all other forms are included there. No? Other tradition may think differently. But the point is that from the Gaudiya rasa perspective, we'll say all forms of God are included within Krishna. For if we say Krishna, everything is included there. But even if you disagree with, okay, I don't feel like Krishna is the source of everything, I'm a Sri Vaishnava or whatever, it's fine. But still, the claim is Krishna indicates other forms of God. So that's one important point that he makes. And then comes another very interesting point, which is very inclusivistic, that Jiva Goswami says, and that referred to in evolution and divine love. But he says, with this consideration, anushilanam, no, remember, is connected to Krishna, means service for Krishna directly, or for those things that are related to Krishna. And of course, you can interpret that in many ways. You could say, okay, those things are related to Krishna means the Vaishnavas, the eternal associates, the guru, Tulsi, the Bhagavatam. But that you can also expand that and say, and take it really literally for what it says, is service to those things that are related to Krishna. And everything is related to Krishna. That's Sambandha, right? That's the lesson 101 you learn in the Bhakti school. Sambandha Gyan is everything is interconnected with the common center. And then Jiva Goswami concludes after saying that because this definition of Krishna Anusilanam includes Krishna, but also what is connected to Krishna, the definition avoids the fault of being too narrow. So he himself says, if you just limit bhakti to God, that's too narrow. That's the mentality of the Kanishta Bhakta by definition. God and me. I have no clue how to relate to anything else, to anyone else. But I open the altar, I do my puja, that's great, Krishna Ki Jai. Then I have no clue what to do with my life. So I open the altar again. Escape there. So here, Jiva Goswami say, no, Krishna plus whatever is in connection to Krishna, which is everything. Then the definition is not narrow. It's broad enough. It's all encompassing, actually. So again, because Krishna, the word Krishna in this case means Krishna plus whatever exists in connection to Krishna, which is everything. Sometimes we use the word Sri Krishna. The word Sri many times is like a reference to, of course, Sri Radha, and somehow she's the embodiment of Shakti. But there are so many Shaktis. So sometimes Sri Krishna means Krishna plus his Shaktis, which means basically the totality of reality, because there is nothing apart from God and his energies. So when we say serve Sri Krishna, it's another way of saying serving everything. Because if you say God, Shaktiman plus Shakti, Swarup Shakti, Tadasta Shakti, Maya Shakti. Okay, everything is there. So, because Krishna means those connected with Krishna, our bhakti cannot be separated from how we treat other beings. We'll see a few other verses these days in that sense, the importance of, okay, because everything is connected to the center. How I'm supposed to relate to everything, to honor everything. There are so many verses about that. So therefore, when we properly understand what we mean by Krishna Anusilanam, that's expanding rather than contracting the circle of our care. Okay? It's not contracting. Okay, I have to love Krishna. And I become obsessed with my blue god, and I'm completely dysfunctional with everyone else in the world. You didn't get it. You didn't understand Krishna Anusilanam. Properly understood, Krishna Anusilanam expands your circle of care till it embraces everything and everyone. So before bhakti, we may come to bhakti with our circle of care. I don't know, my family, my friends. Then, with the wrong understanding of bhakti, you discard all of that and you just concentrate on Krishna. Then it expands a little bit more to the Vaishnavas, and that's it. So that's limited, and how you came to bhakti was limited also because it was just limited to friends and family. Now it includes Krishna, but it discarded them. So in both cases, it's like partial. So a proper understanding is it sets the center in place. Course, and those who represent the center are especially venerable, but properly understood is all encompassing. Everything belongs. No, this the circle of belonging expands to the point that there is no one left outside. So all of that is implied by Krishna Anusilanam. Just got stuck there. Stuck, hopefully, for eternity. Okay, let's continue. Anukulyena, very important words. Probably the most important, maybe. Not to make any hierarchy. My favorite, let's put it that way. Anukulyena means how we have it translated here, perform in a way pleasing to him. Again, when we say him, it's not limited to Krishna. We already clarified what do we mean by Krishna. Krishna plus everything. So the word anukulina means with favor, how is it in English? Favorableness. With a favorable spirit. Favorable doesn't mean in a calculated way to get what I want the most. Because people, who knows how you interpret favorable. Favorable to me. I know favorable. Pleasing to the object of my affection. How can I invoke the highest possible good for my beloved? That's the concern. Not so much how can I get what I want the most by manipulating the other person. So Anukulyena is qualifying Krishna Anusilanam. Because so far we talked about establish the center in place, engage your body, your emotions. But what about your intentionality? So anukulyena comes with intentionality, a favorable intentionality. As I like always to say, bhakti is deeply intentional. Voluntary, again, it has to be a free choice to love, to serve. And voluntary means I'm invited to invest my intentionality there. Not only shall I do it or not, but how I do it. From which place I do it. That's free will is not just you want to love God or you don't want to love God. But then comes the next question. If you say, yes, I want to love God, how? I don't want to love God. Okay, how you don't want to love? Also, people is asking. Not maybe in that way, but we have all these questions about in specificity and intentionality. So anukulyena. This word Anukul appears all over. We talked the other day in Switzerland about Gadadhar Pandit and Sri Radha, how the mood of Radha is Anukulbha. She doesn't have a mood in particular. She has all the moods and whatever at her disposal. The menu is endless. But her actual mood is Anukulbha, whatever is favorable for the pleasure of Krishna at any given moment, that the mood she embraces. It's not like my mood is, no. My mood is in connection to whatever is a necessity of service. So favorability, favorableness. The first even limb of Sharanagati or surrender start with that Anukulyasa Sankalpa, right? Pratikulyasa Vardhanam, and so on. Anukulyasa Sankalpa means make a firm vow, a firm determination about embracing what is favorable for bhakti. And of course, what is favorable for bhakti means also what is favorable for you at this time in bhakti, which may not be the same yesterday and tomorrow, last year, or to the other person. So how can you practice bhakti in a favorable way? Of course, so anukul can go in both directions. Of course, a favorable intention for the pleasure of Krishna, but also all that done in a way that is favorable to me, not in a selfish way, but in a way that is healthy and sustainable. You follow my point? Because you can, I don't know, study the life of Raghunath Das Goswami and see his degree of dedication and love, and you can definitely know, okay, this favor, this is all, this is done in the spirit, in a spirit that is favorable for Krishna's pleasure. But if you try to imitate that, that may become unfavorable to you because you are not Raghunath Das Goswami, and you can be overwhelmed by that level of bhakti that is still shoe too big to enter into. So Anukul can be also interpreted in that way. No? However, you try to pursue something within favorable intentionality, do it in a way that is not firing back as damaging to you. And now comes an interesting, in terms of Anukul, Jiva Goswami mentioned something very interesting. And again, he's further clarifying, say, some people could say Anushilanam is enough to define bhakti. Because Anukulya is already implied in the word Anushilanam, he will say. No? Because if one says bhakti means actions directed to Krishna, Krishna Anushilanam, some will say, oh, that's a sufficient definition. Anukulyena is redundant. But he says not necessarily, because an action may be directed to Krishna, but it's not necessarily directed with the favorable intentionality. And he gives examples, of course, to illustrate this. One example could be Kamsa. Kamsa was 24/7 absorbed in Krishna. He was engaging Krishna Anushilana, ongoing, continuous cultivation of thoughts toward Krishna. And we say, oh, thinking about Krishna is very important. Smarta vyasa Vishnu. Oh, we think about Krishna, never forget him. Kamsa is doing that. Right? Yes. But which was intention? Fear that he will be killed by Krishna, planning to kill Krishna so he's not killed by Krishna. So that's not anukulin. To follow the point?
Yeah.
So this is not enough. As much as it's already in as many things as is here, still you need Anukulina to define bhakti even in a more coherent way. Because Kamsa thinking 24 hours about Krishna, that's Krishna Anushilana. But that's not Anukulina Krishna Anushilana. That's Pratikulina Krishna Anushilana. He's thinking about Krishna in a unfavorable way. He wants to kill him. And on the other way, he gives another example to create a little bit more nuance. Some actions may not seem as directly favorable to Krishna externally, but if the intention is there, they're considered Anukulina Krishna Anushilana. Like Gita showed us, running after Krishna with stick in hand and tying him to a mortar. On the outside, that seems like that's not favorable. That's not bhakti. That's not service. She's chasing God and tying him. But investigate her heart. What's her intentionality? Anukulyena. That's totally an overflow of Vatsalya rasa. So it doesn't look like Anushilanam, what the Yashoda is doing, but it's filled with Anukulina. So if there's Anukulina to that degree, then that's also Krishna Anushilanam. The time Krishna is kind of just sort of putting conditions in the context of unconditional love. Like a mom to a child. The mom loves the kid unconditionally, but the kid starts to behave a little bit mischievously. So I will put some conditions so he doesn't get spoiled. Okay, I will tie him to a mortar. Sounds a little bit too much, but the commentators comment that. They just said I was afraid. Oh, if Krishna continues doing this, he will grow dysfunctional. So I'll keep him tied for a moment. So it was with a loving concern for his son's future, to say. Right? So she was putting some conditions in the context of unconditional love, as we talked many times. There's place for that. And Jiva Goswami says this Anukulina, of course, as we already say, Anukulina Krishna Anushilanam, this whole line. He says continuous service or emotions directed toward Krishna, his other forms or things related to him with a pleasing attitude is the essential characteristic of bhakti. So that's Swarupa Lakshan. So far we have finished the first half. So that's what bhakti is in a positive way to define it. Continuous ongoing engagement, service, action, and emotion. Again, it's not just things we do, but it's an inner disposition that sometimes translates into things we do with an intentional, pleasing attitude, voluntary investment toward Krishna or other forms of the divine, and by extension, everything connection to him. So if you understand each one of these stage is very comprehensive. It doesn't leave anything out. And it doesn't allow for self-deception also. It's challenging because also it shows, again, mirror, how much we may be falling short of that. We will try. We will have breakfast at the time we agreed yesterday. We have to still have some time. Let me go to Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur's commentary for a moment in connection to Anukulina before we move to the other part. He says some interesting thing, and I will be mostly reading. He says the definition of Anukulya as pleasing for Krishna is both too extensive and too limiting. So now he brings further problems. But again, all for the sake of refining and getting a very sharp, coherent definition. For example, the action, Anushilanam, of a demon attacking Krishna. Now he brings another layer. It's the rasa fighting, Yudhabhira rasa. Like, I don't know, Hiranyakashipu is attacking Nrisimhadev. So you could say, okay, that doesn't look like serving Krishna, but Krishna is relishing Yudha Rasa, which is the rasa of chivalry.
Yes.
No? So actually that's giving pleasure to Krishna. So it's pleasing to him because he takes pleasure in fighting with them. Again, an illustration of the definition being too limited. Now, if Anukulya means pleasing to Krishna, again, it's given because again, these demons didn't want to please Krishna, but Krishna has been pleased. So that's interesting. When Yashoda left Krishna and went to take the milk off the fire, Krishna was not pleased. So again, that was not pleasing to Krishna. Again, we are getting subtle. Going back to what she was going to take care, and he will say that in a moment. She just went to take care of this milk that was being cooked for making sweets for the pleasure of Krishna. And the milk was about, there are different lilas that the Acharyas say that the milk thought I'm being neglected and Yashoda is breastfeeding Krishna and the two of us are looking at each other and absorbed in love and the milk thought this will go on forever.
Oh, yeah.
Krishna is drinking this milk. Yashoda is giving this milk, the two eyeball to eyeball, looking at each other. This will go on forever. And me, milk, who I'm boiling on the stove, I will never get a chance to serve Krishna. So I better commit suicide. A poetic way, and the milk starts to boil, to overflow, which is the milk suicide. So just everything is personalized, radical personalism. And Yashoda sees that and she leaves Krishna, stops the breastfeeding, and goes to save the milk, to engage the milk in seva. So it's in the sake of Krishna, because that milk is destined for Krishna, and the milk is a Vaishnava or a Vaishnavi. So she's saving a Vaishnava. So it's all one same project. But Krishna is not pleased. I mean, he's not that he's not pleased, but in one level, he's like, why this was interrupted? So again, in one sense, we say that was not anukulina because it was not pleasing to Krishna. But again, the intention of pleasing was there in Yashoda's heart. So we are getting there. So Vrishvanatha Chakravarti said, in order to prevent the definition of anukulina being too extensive or too limiting, the definition of anukul should be explained as devoid of hostility on the part of the performer. That's one first part. So this will exclude the demons, right? Because they had hostility in the form of hatred to Krishna. And this definition will also not exclude Yashoda because she is devoid of hostility to Krishna. And he concludes, therefore, let bhakti be defined in terms of anukulya, a friendly attitude directed to Krishna. So it's not just devoid of hostility, but a friendly attitude, a loving, favorable attitude. And then he concludes saying, someone may argue, therefore, the word anushilanam, which is modified by anukulya, is unnecessary because bhakti can be defined merely as favorable attitude to Krishna. No, I have good intention. I have this intention. And he said, this objection is rejected since even a pot is devoid of hostility toward Krishna. And is in one sense, we could say it's pleasing to him. Well, Krishna is so generous that it's your this devoid of hostility, he's pleased to that. But you cannot say that the pot has bhakti. Therefore, anushilam is also necessary. So you have certain intention, but that translates into how you act, how you feel, how you express yourself. So anyhow, before moving forward, anukulim is intentionality. So not merely what I'm doing, but from what disposition I am doing it, towards whose good. And again, there's place for apply anukulina for us. So anukul means sustainable, healthy for us, but it's not all about us. We are not the center. We already say who's the center. Okay, let's move to the other part, which will be briefer. This was the main part because it was the main qualities of bhakti. So the secondary part, which is the first line, will be shorter because it's just the byproduct of the first part. Anyavilasita shunyam jnana karmadinavritam. These are tatastha lakshan, or secondary marginal qualities of bhakti that come as a byproduct of the first, the primary qualities, the positive ones. So anyavilasita shunyam technically means bhakti is devoid of other desires. Shunya means like empty, like the shunyavad in Buddhism. Shunya means empty or devoid of. Anya avilasita. Avilas means desire, and anya means other. Doesn't mean it's devoid of all desires. So Anya is qualifying that. Okay, and this comes as a byproduct because you are, keep this in context of this. You are cultivating in an ongoing way with Krishna in the center and everything connected to him in a favorable way and so on and so forth. Naturally, as a byproduct of that, you get rid free from all other desires except for what we just explained before. All separate desires. At least in principle, that's how it will play out as a symptom, as a concomitant symptom. So anya abhilasita sunyam. This doesn't mean that bhakti is devoid of desires. Again, bhakti is devoid of desires that are anya, that are separate, no? Separatistic. No? That's the main thing here. No? And again, we may still indulge in all of that, as I say before, but at least we can get this clear definition and orientation and know, yeah, if I want to love God and love everything connection to God, including me, like we talked many times, self-love in bhakti, for me to be coherent and aligned with that definition, I cannot harbor desires which are separatistic, no? Me as separate from the rest, me as an isolated unit, me as an island. That goes against the core definition of bhakti. But we need desires. Again, here is not a canceling. We need desires. Like someone asked one Prabhupada, so shall we get rid of attachment? No. Krishna consciousness is the science of attachment. We just need to get attached to Krishna. So the real question here, and again, we are all probably experiencing still some of this anya abhilas. The shunyam part hasn't come yet. It's anya abhilas. Still, I have other desires. Still, I'm pursuing things in ways that somehow I'm not making them belong to Krishna in the center. And again, not to make anyone feel neurotic, just like an honest assessment of the field. And if that's not the case, great. Congratulations. But the question is not so much whether secondary desires still arise or not, but the question is whether they are beginning to govern bhakti. No? Are they becoming the priority in my life or not? No? Or are these desires being brought in relationship to bhakti? Which are my priorities, basically? Some of you can say, okay, I want a car, I want a wife, I want this, I need this. And you may know that's not the deepest desire in the world. I mean, the ultimate thing, not to downplay any of that. But okay, how can I bring all that into my bhakti project? So it doesn't remain like a, how to say, like an alienated, like a parallel life, what to say. Again, my material life, my spiritual life. No need to do that. Whatever we feel I still need personally because of my desires or whatever, my conditioning, if you want to use that word, I have no problem. Okay, how to bring that into bhakti? Bhakti is user-friendly enough to allow everything to be brought into it. Everything, as much as we are not bringing any crazy madness in the name of bhakti. But in general, yeah, we can grow like Krishna says to Uddhava in the Bhagavatam. You can offer me whatever is favorite to me, or you can offer me whatever is favorite to you. So Krishna is very generous. He's not just saying, okay, I like pakoras. If you don't like, sorry for you. Right? That's what the menu is about. Offer what I like. Well, Krishna, they say, no, I can see that you are not so much identified with Anukulyena Krishna Anusilanam, yet you are not so identified with giving pleasure to me, what I want in a favorable way. You are more about what you like and what you want. Okay, pursue that and include me somehow in your life. That's kind of the spirit. Make me part of you. I want to be part of your life. Krishna say, I want to be part. Can you make me part of your life? No. No, I don't want to kind of make you part. I have all this to say. Yeah, it's fine. I'm not saying you stop those, but somehow make me fit in between there, or something like that. Right? Let's start somewhere. Not like Krishna saying in the Gita, some people worship me because they want money, fame, knowledge. They don't want me. Right? They engage in bhakti for other reasons. Again, that's not Uttam bhakti. That's other forms of diluted bhakti. Krishna said, okay. No. Of course, again, here the definition is aspirational, and in that aspirational is given space for those who are not up to the mark. So to say, we may have, I need this and I want this and I need that and I want that. Because it's okay. Even you can pray to me for me to fulfill that desires. He says that. And of course, he says also in the bottom, but if you do that, I will try to fulfill those desires in a way that you don't keep praying to me for to fulfill the same desires over and over again. But that you're praying and your desires become more and more refined. So we finally can desire one another fully and purely. Because that's the perfection of desire. So Krishna wants to take us to the perfection of desire. He doesn't want to repress our desires. He says in the Gita, what do you gain by repression? Another rhetorical question. You gain nothing. So again, the idea, the spirit in Anya Bilasita Srinam is not so much, do you have separate desires or not? If you have, you're not qualified for bhakti. Get out of here. But it's like a sincere recognition. If that's going on, how can I invite Krishna into the picture? How can I connect that somehow? How can I be creative and at the same time understand aspirationally what's the perfection of desire, and from whatever I am, gradually move toward that by including Krishna. So if you don't like pakoras that much, and that's Krishna's favorite, and you're like, I'm all up for pizza, and I'm not sure if Krishna likes that, that's not described in the scripture. Okay, offer that to Krishna. Like Prabhupada will say when he came to the West, someone will come, oh, I cannot give up drinking wine. Okay, offer the wine to Krishna. No, offer that in different situations. But don't lose your favorable spirit. Like yesterday we were talking with Gauram Prabhu, and he gave this other example of Srila Sridhar Maharaj to one devotee. Came, oh, my husband has problem with smoking and all that, and Srila Sridhar Maharaj will say like, oh, you get an ashtray for him. Like implying that, no, not like implying that's you have to honor that act, but okay, support him, accompany him in his wherever he is, and eventually that will be transcendent, which was the case. No? As long as the person remains favorable and open, okay, there's that thing there. Okay, don't condemn that. It's part of the journey. As long as we have the primary aspect of bhakti in place, the other things will fall into place gradually.
Ultimate purifier.
Yeah, the ultimate purifier, Pavitram. Ambishwanath Chakravarti Thakur also comments on Anyabhilashita Sunyam. No, free from other desire, mentioning this important point that we always mention, which is bhakti aims at bhakti. So in that sense, it's free from other desires. At least again, in principle, in aspiration. So bhakti, which aims at achieving bhakti, is the bhakti that is being described here, uttam bhakti, and therefore is free from all other desires but bhakti. Right? So here it's not like, oh, I want to practice bhakti for mukti. I want to practice bhakti for bhukti, for swargalok, for this, for that. I want to practice bhakti for bhakti. At least in principle, I'm charmed by that idea. In practice, I'm still falling short from that. But in principle, I embrace that ideal, and I have the faith that by embracing that ideal, I will be gradually upgraded in my realization in my living practice to the idea itself. Short. And we'll go to the final part of the verse, which is jnana karma adi anavritam. It's just all one. So anavritam means, as we corrected, it was unobscured. Anavritam. Avritam means obscured. Anavritam means unobscured. Jnana karma adi. Jnana means jnana. Karma means karma. And adi means etc. So bhakti is unobscured by jnana and karma and etc. So what does it mean? Jnana in this one way can mean the inquiry into impersonal Brahman, which is what whomever wants to go get there, they will embrace jnana, the path known as jnana. So uttam bhakti is free from that. There's not like a concern in that direction. Also, you can take jnana in a more fascination with information, just filling your head with content and making it all head stuff. So bhakti is not about that. There is jnana. That's again the important thing here, similar to the other. Anyabhilasita Shunyam, bhakti is free from all other desires, not for all, it's not a canceling of desire altogether. And now says Jnana Karmadi Navritam. Bhakti is unobscured by certain type of knowledge and action, karma, but that doesn't mean that there's no knowledge nor no action in bhakti. In fact, there's lots of that. As we say yesterday, Raja Vidya, bhakti in itself is the king of knowledge. And there's knowledge to practice bhakti. There is Sambandha Gyan, there's scriptural knowledge, guru gives knowledge. But all that knowledge is bhakti. It's not Gyan. And karma, in this case, when we say bhakti is unobscured by karma, refers more to these rituals and activities performed in certain Vedic circles, periodic duties to reach heavenly planets or to do this or to do that, to please the gods to, in order to obtain something else. So bhakti is unobscured by that, which doesn't mean there is no karma. And karma here means action. We already explained it's filled with action. Anushilanam. It's a continuous cultivation of action. And adi means renunciation, other things. Bhakti is unobscured by that. Again, there may be a form of renunciation that comes as a result of bhakti, but it doesn't start with renunciation, as we say yesterday. First, I have to be renounced, then I can practice bhakti. So again, the intention of the word anavritam, unobscured, means those things, action, certain form of action, certain form of knowledge can be there, but it's not obscure in bhakti. Even Jiva Goswami in the commentary gives an example. He says, for example, devotees do not need necessarily engage in some of these Shraddha ceremonies for the ancestors or this or that, that if I have to do that to secure this or that. But a devotee may participate in one of those ceremonies out of a social custom to not disturb his family. But he's not thinking, I need to do this to increase my bhakti. No, he knows that just bhakti is enough. So I don't need to resort to this other ritual or this other practice, but just by doing bhakti, that's a very definition of Shraddha. Given by Krishna Das Kaviraj Goswami. Shraddha sabde kahi, Shraddha, Shraddha kahi, Shraddha sabde kahi vishvasu dhrida nishchay, sarva, Krishna bhakti sarva karma. There's always one word that is missing that verse. Shraddha sabde vishvas kahi sudhrida nishchay, Krishna bhakti sarva karma krita hoy, and I'm missing one word. Which basically means Shraddha for us means that the faith that the devotee has is that by performing bhakti, I don't need to do anything else. And of course, everything in my life can become an ex bhakti and an extension of bhakti. So I don't need to resort to this ritual, to this worship, to this pleasing Indra and pleasing that and worship the ancestors. I mean, you can do that if you want, but not you don't need to think, oh, I have to do it, because if I don't do it, it gets in the way of my bhakti. So that's why Jiva Goswami say, yeah, some devotee can engage in some karma and some. By the time he's writing in India 500 years ago, there was lots of that. So some devotee, yeah, in their family, something happened and he's invited to participate in this ritual. But he's not thinking, I need to do this because if not, my bhakti will have a problem. Bhakti comes from bhakti and bhakti is its own thing, so to say, right? So anyhow, this is the indirect way of describing, which again is very user-friendly because it's saying, speaking about desires, but not canceling all desire, but just inviting for an aligning of desire. Speaking about certain, how bhakti is unobscured by certain actions and knowledge, but not saying all actions, all knowledge are like cancel. So there's place for everything aligned with bhakti, and that's bhakti uttama. So knowledge, action, discipline, renunciation even are not rejected. Again, the issue is whether they are serving bhakti or they are becoming coverings that make life revolve around mastery and achievement and superiority or personal liberation, which many times all the things are attached to renunciation and knowledge and this and that. So the definition of Rupa Goswami tries to make sure we are not going there in the name of Bhakti or in the name of Uttam Bhakti. So this is the definition, and these are a few words, just there's so much more we can say, but just for us to get a glimpse of how much we can think about bhakti. And of course, later we'll have some exercise for us to sit with the verse and to unpack and to contemplate, to integrate that. Actually, this verse, and I won't go into the detail, but this verse by Rupa Goswami is composed based on upon another verse, ancient verse from the Narada Pancharatra that he quotes immediately after this one, which is 12, Sarvopadi Vinirmuktam Tat Paratvena Nirmalam Hrishikena Hrishiket Sivanam Bhakti Ruchati, which is basically like a parallel verse. But I will say here in this verse, Rupa Goswami makes the content even more explicit. And then he quotes after that verses from the Srimad Bhagavatam that basically are also like parallels to that. So there are many verses defining bhakti, which basically say the same from different angles to make sure we are getting the idea right. So when we get a proper definition, a working definition of bhakti, we can, again, even if it feels aspirational, as I say before, it's very important to have a definition in place, an aspiration in place. And I really appreciate how this beautiful verse defines bhakti, not so much like, I don't know, like religious affiliation or something like that, but in terms of the structure of love itself, you know? Like it's intentional, it's embodied, it's favorable, it's increasingly free from separate agenda, from dualism. That's how it should be, I will say. Okay. Let's put my sharing to rest. We'll conclude with a little exercise, and then we'll go for breakfast. And later, I will be sharing in the WhatsApp group the writing prompt and contemplation and sharing based on this verse or later today. And later today, we also have Q&A. So if you have questions around this that come later or you have today, we can address them later or any other topic. So we'll do an exercise with. Okay, we'll do a group of four and all the other groups of three. 2 minutes to speak per person. As usual, we keep that structure so we don't make it too complicated. I will have three prompts. I'll be sharing them now and later also. So the first one is where in your bhakti do you still find yourself bargaining with Krishna? Confession time. Where in your bhakti do you still find yourself bargaining with Krishna? Again, nothing to make anyone feel toxically shamed or something. Where in your bhakti do you still find yourself bargaining with Krishna? Number two, how does that hidden bargain, because generally it's hidden, how does that hidden bargain shape the way you practice? How does that hidden bargain shape the way you practice or the way you relate or respond when things do not go as you hoped? So how does that hidden bargain shape the way you practice, relate, or respond when things do not go as you hoped? And the third one, and for those of you who are watching the recording, then later, I'm recording this part because you may like to do the exercise yourself or with some other friends over there. That's the intention why I'll keep this in the recording also. And the last one is, what could you do more intentionally? Going to intentionality. What could you do more intentionally so that this part of your bhakti, what could you do more intentionally that this part of your bhakti becomes less of a transaction and more of a favorable offering? What could you do more intentionally so that this part of your bhakti becomes less transactional or less of a transaction and more of a favorable offering? Okay, so I'll stop the recording and mention the groups. Srila Rupa Goswami, Prabhupada ki jai, Sri Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu ki jai, Sriman Mahaprabhu ki jai, Harinam Prabhu ki jai, Sadhu Sangha ki jai, Gaur Premanand.